Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 301 for June 12th, 2017. Steve Henn, co-founder of 60DB. Triangulation is brought to you by Hover. Finding the perfect domain name is incredibly easy with Hover. Go to hover.com/triangulation and save 10% off your first purchase. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. I'm Nathan Olivares-Giles, and this is Triangulation, the show where we talk with some of the most interesting people in and around the technology industry. Our guest today is Steve Henn, the co-founder of 60DB.
Hey.
This is an app that, if you like podcasts, and you probably do because you're listening to this show right now, you need to be checking out 60DB. It's actually one of my favorite new apps, like in the last year or something. How long have you guys been around now?
So we launched our first version in October 27th, just a few days before the election.
Wow. Great timing.
Yeah. No, it was interesting. We have a little newsroom, so it was like, it was a pretty busy few weeks.
Yeah.
But the app has changed a lot. We went through a big redesign.
I do really like the redesign. Feels it kind of matches the flat themes that are so popular across so many different apps these days.
Yeah, I love it just because I can, like, the thing that makes 60DB different than most podcast apps is that we create a playlist of short form stories and we mix it together, and it's based on your interests. Mm-hmm. And everyone's playlist is going to be different. The redesign also made it really easy for you to get at your longer form podcasts really quickly. So as new podcasts that you follow flow into the system, they will show up on the homepage right under the sort of the morning news feed or the evening news feed.
Yeah, I've enjoyed that. For those who haven't tried the app out yet, basically there's you can follow all the same podcasts you have. I was able to import mine in from the regular Apple Podcasts app.
Right.
And basically I'm adding the longer form stuff to my playlist. I'm downloading that so I can listen to it as I drive, you know, out to the studio here in Petaluma.
Right.
And then the short form stuff I'm usually listening to like in the morning as I'm like brushing my teeth, getting ready for work, getting dressed, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a good mix.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, we've been working really hard on it in part just to get it out across as many different platforms as possible. So I think the big news since Liz Gaines, who's a reporter at 60DB, was here last, we've launched a Android app. It's out of beta. So if you're an Android user, you can check that out. We are also on Android Auto and CarPlay, and we have an Alexa skill.
Mm-hmm.
And so really our goal is to make this listening experience work across any place you want to listen that's connected to your speakers. So you can, send it to your television set, listen that way through Chromecast or Apple TV.
Yeah, you definitely seem to be in all the right places, all the places you'd want to be at this point.
Right.
There are a couple places I'd like to see 60DB. We can get to that a little bit later, but
yeah.
I want to start a little bit. We now broke down what the app itself is.
Sure.
And I am definitely a fan of it. But as a journalist myself, and yourself, I want to talk about who you were before 60DB a little bit.
Yeah.
If you've listened to Planet Money, if you've listened to NPR, you've probably heard Steve's voice before. Let's talk a little bit about what your career looked like before that.
Yeah. So I spent my entire career in public radio, really. I mean, I had worked for a couple newspapers, like small local papers when I was getting started, city council meetings, school board meetings, that kind of stuff. But mostly I've worked either for a local public radio station in Washington, D.C. or Marketplace, and then most recently for NPR and Planet Money. And it was a great gig. I love public radio.
NPR's, if you're into audio storytelling, audio journalism, that's NPR is kind of the gold standard, the pinnacle in many different ways of what you would want to do as a daily reporter.
Yeah. You know, one of the amazing things about working there was that my last few years I was covering the technology industry, my last 6 years. And you could call up so many interesting, intelligent people and they would return your calls, right? Like all of my colleagues had done such great work for so long that I would, you know, you just had an enormous amount of credibility and an ability to get in the room with people who were doing really interesting research and credible thinkers. And it was an exciting place to work. It was the place when I graduated from college, I was like, that's what I want to do.
Yeah.
And so it was a strange feeling to get there and to be working at Planet Money, which was a blast.
Yeah.
And to a groundbreaking decide to leave.
Show. Right? Yeah, well, Planet Money was kind of a groundbreaking show because, you know, after the financial crisis, something that affected everybody in the country and international markets and really, really the global economy, you all did such a good job. And of course, journalism is a team sport, so it wasn't just you. But
well, I wasn't there when it started, so it wasn't me
okay.
at all.
All right. But that whole idea of like making something that seems intimidating, that seems not accessible, something that anyone can connect with, like finding entry points into the story, right. Understanding how economics and the stock market affect you and those sorts of things, right?
Yeah. I think, you know, so in the early part of my career, I was at Marketplace and Adam Davidson, who was a co-founder of Planet Money, spent some time there as well. And I think both of those shows, they're very different, but they both shared the goal of trying to take really complicated issues and make them accessible and tell stories that are accessible but also accurate and really informative that, you know, would engage the experts in the field but also bring along everyone else. And, you know, Adam and Alex Bloomberg, who founded it, did that as well as anyone. And I think that's carrying on today in the team there. So it was a great place to work, and it was a tough job to leave.
Well, yeah, let's talk about how difficult that must have been to make that decision, or easy, because, you know, not a lot of journalists go into being startup co-founders or doing what you're doing now. Why did you feel the need to do this, to go start what is essentially a podcast app?
Sure. So I moved to Silicon Valley in 2010. And at the time, I came because of my wife's career. It was right after the financial crisis. I had a gig at Marketplace covering money and politics and all of the like financial disruption that was going on then. And I left that job because it was clear to me that radio was going to go through a digital transformation. And it was also clear to me that the transformation that print journalism was going through and is going through hadn't played out well. It had been devastating for really high quality reporting. I mean, you know, you were at the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah.
And it, you know, that paper was sold, you know, the Washington Post.
Yeah, I was at the LA Times under the Sam Zell's Tribune reign, the Daily Star in Tucson, Arizona Daily Star. So I've gone from the local national, seen it all on those levels. And yeah, devastating, definitely. You know, massive layoffs and like you said, still something that the industry is struggling with.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that happened with newspapers is they put everything that they were creating online and they put it out there for free, and then big ad networks, Google and Facebook, started selling ads against them. And newspapers lost control of their ad sales. The price of digital ad sales began to plummet because supply exploded. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, subscribers began canceling because there was no reason to subscribe. And so their business model was sort of attacked from a number of different ways. And I was seeing in the podcast space similar trends, right? So right now, podcasts are all ad driven. We're going to do an ad break later.
Yep.
But I think in the long term, it'll be better for Twit. It'll be better for creators. It'll be better for journalists if there are more ways than just advertising to support great work. So, you know, this hasn't, you know, we haven't developed our full platform of services for publishers yet. But I think in the future, you know, things like subscription or the ability to directly donate to a publisher are going to be important components of preserving great journalism. I also honestly saw an opportunity to take some of the things that NPR does well and make them just more broadly accessible, right? So like, you know, NPR speaks really powerfully to about 1 in 10 Americans, 30 million people, right? And it's public radio. So, like, by that measure, it's not serving the entire public. And one of the reasons I think that's true is it has, you know, if you run a radio station, you have 24 hours of programming. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're playing Garrison Keillor or Car Talk, you know, people expect, wait, wait, don't tell me next, right? So you have to serve an audience, and there's a certain inertia in radio programming or, you know, linear television programming. And so it made it really difficult for even the best intentioned public radio programmers to put on shows that appealed to different audiences in their communities. That doesn't have to be true in a digital environment, right? So, like, if you're on 60 dB and I'm making a playlist just for you, like, the variety of voices that we can incorporate and bring to, you know, the public, the listening public, just expands dramatically.
Yeah. So, yeah, your shows aren't necessarily confined to that structure of
right.
24 hours of programming.
It's, right.
And as much as you can get on there, and then we can pick it anytime we want, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. And I just think that allows your listening experience to be different, and that creates a market for, you know, journalism that's just more diverse. So I made a playlist for you.
Oh, okay.
Before I came on the show.
And that other people will be able to see in the app.
Right,
okay.
Right. So if you load the app later today and go to the Discover page, you should see Nate's smiling face, and you'll be able to, like, peer into what I think is basically what your daily feed looks like.
It's probably a mixture of, like, soccer podcasts, technology podcasts, and some political news, probably.
Right. Yeah. I gave you some NPR stuff because I knew you were an NPR fan.
Yeah.
I gave you some of the journalism we're doing on our own in 60 mm-hmm. dB. So a bunch of reporters work with on a team I manage, and we talk to newspaper reporters all over the world. So you're going to get those.
Okay.
And then I put a lot of comedy in there. So, like,
oh, yeah. I definitely have a lot of that stuff. You know, John Oliver's in there.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So you get Last Week Tonight and The Daily Show, Larry Wilmore's new show.
Love Wilmore. Yeah.
So it's like it's a mix of video and audio.
Well, we're going to have to see how accurate that is. It sounds like you got it nailed, though.
Right.
But, I mean, that would probably make sense since you probably have the data on what I'm listening to.
Well, we talked about it.
Yeah.
Oh, well, there's that too. I didn't creep.
Full disclosure,
creep you.
Steve and I know each other, and we were texting all weekend, and from time to time we check in
and
keep in touch with each other. We used to run into each other as tech reporters
right.
when you were doing your NPR thing.
I think I met you at the Grand Canyon.
Thing. Yeah, that's right. Okay, so side story. I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona, but I'm terrible at being like a tourist in my own place. I never went to the Grand Canyon until I came to San Francisco. I was a reporter at Wired at the time. So yeah, that was the first time we met.
Yeah.
It was a Google Street View backpack.
Yeah. That was cool.
The maiden voyage. That was the first time they ever used that backpack to collect data for Google Maps for public release. Before that, it was all just testing. So.
Yeah.
Anyways, that being said, you used to be with me in the trenches,
right,
side by side. And how has that experience, you know, one of the better careers as a radio reporter that you could have, really, how has that prepared you or not for this startup life? Because this is a whole different world. This is a whole different industry, and you're doing so much. Well, maybe we should start with what you're doing exactly.
Sure.
Because you're doing business side stuff, you're doing editorial stuff, and then we can get into...
Well, I have two incredible co-founders mm-hmm. who came from Netflix. John Ciancuti, who was the fourth engineer hired. He was hired as like a 20-something kid.
Yeah.
And realized early on, like late 90s, that like if you went to Netflix's website, they would show you movies that were out of stock. He's like, this is stupid.
Why are we doing that?
Yeah. Why are we doing this?
Yeah.
And so he's like, we should just not show people movies that we can't actually give to them. Mm-hmm. And so they did that. And then he's like, maybe we should personalize the website and make it dynamic. And that was actually a huge insight that's changed the way the web works. Mm-hmm. Netflix was one of the first people to do it. If John tells the story, he'll say it. You know, he hired people smarter than he was. And then another guy from Netflix. So Steve McClendon, who does our product management, he's responsible for the look and feel of the app and a lot of other stuff, more stuff than I could name. So I'm doing a lot, but we have a great team.
Yeah.
But I basically manage content relationships. So we have deals with ESPN and a bunch of public radio shows like The Takeaway from WNYC and Here and Now from NPR and WBUR. Mm-hmm. So I close those deals. And then I also manage a team, including Liz Gaines. We have a couple reporters in Austin, Texas, Brenda Salinas and Hannah McBride. And a couple people in New York, Michael Simon Johnson, notably, and Lewis Wallace. And those guys, they reach out to more than, like, I think we've worked with 80 publishers. So, like, we talked to you at the Wall Street Journal when you were there. Yeah. And we do interviews, and then we create radio stories where we bring in extra tape. And so we have our own unique stories on the platform as well. And this all becomes sort of this mix that... Yeah.
So I mean, that's a pretty varied role.
Mm-hmm.
With what we were doing, you know, back when you were a tech reporter too.
Yeah.
How does it inform what you're doing, or has it been a hindrance in some ways? Has it prepared you for what you're doing?
Well, the editorial stuff is pretty straightforward. Mm-hmm. I was a reporter, so I wasn't talking to business leaders at public radio stations or at ESPN, but I was known in that world, and so that provided entree in lots of places, right? Like, people would take my call when we started the business. I think being a reporter teaches you to think analytically. It teaches you to understand a huge amount of diverse information quickly. All of those things are important. I said I came out here 6 years ago because I saw what was happening with newspapers. I wanted to come here, and I gave up my job to move here initially because I wanted to figure out the industry that was likely to change my industry and understand how it worked and try to figure out how I could sort of bend that in a positive direction. And so my experience covering the industry was really helpful. I learned a lot about technology trends. I learned a lot about different players in the space. I met John this way.
Yeah.
It's been an interesting preparation. I think being a reporter is a great career. if you are a curious person and love to learn, it's tough to beat that. And fundamentally, I decided to give that up and do this because there are lots of really talented reporters. I mean, in the world, and specifically at NPR, there were people who were so much more talented at that than I could ever be. And I was worried about the business model that supported their work. And I figured the best chance to preserve their ability to do that work was to create a business that supported it. And 60 dB is really little, but we're already, I think, moving the market in some interesting ways.
Yeah, it's an interesting approach and tactic that you are taking, because a lot of the traditional news organizations and even some of the newer, online media startups and things, their focus seems to be getting their content onto platforms, apps that people are going to, right?
Right.
So the distribution... As you mentioned earlier, the ad sales business that supported journalism was basically annihilated because all the ads went to Google and Facebook and other online competitors for the most part, right? So those independent ad sales businesses shrunk, as well as how much you can get for an ad. Now it seems like a lot of legacy news publications are working toward getting their content on other people's apps and almost giving up the distribution side as well as the business model that they've kind of given up in the past, I would argue. But with 60 dB, you're creating a distribution platform of sorts for news organizations. So rather than just like helping someone get their stuff on YouTube or Facebook or whatever, you're creating a new place to surface those things, which is almost like a tech first kind of approach to this question of what is the future of how people get to the journalism we do.
Yeah, and I think there were two reasons for that. One is I don't think that there was a digital platform that really worked well for audio, right? Like, podcasts are awesome, but podcasts tend to be long because the app ecosystem that exists around them, the podcast app mainly, requires you to press a button to start play, right? And like, imagine if you had to press a button on your radio every time you wanted to hear a new story, right? The types of things you'd listen to would change.
Yeah, dramatically.
Right. And if you think about the radio shows that most people listen to in the morning and the evening when radio is really a daily habit, right? When you're doing something else, most of those shows are made up of shorter 5 to 7 minute segments, right? Mm-hmm. And so the existing apps require that button pushing. The idea was we could take playlisting and the kinds of technologies John had built at Netflix and use that to create an experience that was more, that just worked, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and the other reason we went tech first, I think, goes back to sort of the business model issues that you were thinking about. I mean, Netflix created incredibly awesome television. I watch a lot of Netflix, but beyond what's on Netflix, right? Like HBO has to compete against them. Mm-hmm. Amazon has to compete against them. So there are all these shows that are really driven by what I think is an independent company that wasn't like owned by Amazon or owned by Apple that you know, had a powerful business model behind it. And so by building an independent tech platform, I think we can really drive the industry in a powerful way. And I think that's already happening a little bit, even though we're tiny, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So,
well, it seems like you're off to a good start. We're going to take a break here for an ad. But again, we're here with Steve Henn, the co-founder of 60DB. And we will be back. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Hover. When you've got a great idea for a startup, a blog, whatever your website is, go use Hover to get your domain name. With Hover, it's incredibly easy to set up your domain name with the most popular website builders. Hover has over 400 domain extensions, all the classics like .com and .net, niche extensions like .design and .tech, and quirky extensions like .pizza, .ninja, and even .horse. Once you find your domain, you can use Hover Connect to set up your domain automatically with your website in just a few clicks. You can also use it to get a more on-brand or professional email address. Your domain works with whatever email programs you're already using, and when all you want to do is buy a domain name or email address, you shouldn't have to opt out of page after page of add-ons that you don't want or need. That's why Hover only offers domains and email, so you can focus on finding a great domain name and get back to working on your great idea. Unlike most other domain providers, Hover includes free Whois privacy with all supported domains to keep your information confidential. And if you already have multiple domains scattered across other domain providers, you can save money by bringing them all over to Hover. Eligible domains will include Whois privacy. And with volume discounts, the more domains you have in your account, the more of a discount Hover will automatically apply to your account. With Hover, there's no more digging through articles to figure out how to get your domain working. If you need a hand, give them a call, and Hover's awesome support team is there to help you. No annoying phone trees or transferring to another department. Find a domain name for your idea. Go to hover.com/triangulation and get 10% off your first purchase. That's hover.com/triangulation. Hover, domain names for your ideas. We're back with Steve Henn, the co-founder of 60DB. Thanks again for joining us.
Sure.
So we were just talking about why you all took a tech-first approach to building what is a bit of a journalism business, but at the same time, you all are taking kind of a service approach in some sense. I don't know if that's the right word, but you know, you open up Apple's podcast app or someone else's, and oftentimes it feels like a bit of a utility, right? You see a list, you might see some charts, some here's what's popular, categories, whatever,
right.
And then you just kind of pick and choose. But with what you all are doing on 60DB, which reminds me a lot, no mistake, of what Netflix does still, is a bit of recommendation, a bit of like, okay, you like this, you might also like this, and just kind of helping you discover stuff. And discovery seems to be an ongoing, never-ending problem on the internet anywhere, but especially when it comes to what's that new podcast I should listen to, what's that new app I should download, what's, you know, whatever, right?
Right. Yeah. No, I think that's right. So if you download the app for the first time, you'll walk through a pretty lightweight onboarding, right? It's similar to Apple News if you've ever done that. So we have a bunch of different categories, and within those categories, providers that you can say you're into. So, and we use that to create your first listening experience. Then you can search for things that you're interested in by subject, and you can download your existing podcasts. And all of those things provide the shape of what your feed looks like in the beginning. But the most important data we have actually is what people end up listening to all the way. So we can see, you know, what shows people may sign up for, but
aren't engaging with.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And we can see shows that rise in popularity. And so we can use that to inform what we recommend. So skips, shares, mm-hmm. Listen completion rates, all of the sort of behavior in the app helps us inform discovery, not just for you, but for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so, you know, it gets better with more users.
So with, you know, with all of these different distribution platforms, if you want to call them that, that news agencies are using to get out their work, but also just entertainment. I mean, not every podcast is news, right? A lot of entertainment. You all have a lot of video in there. Let's talk about what you all are doing in terms of data and analytics.
Sure.
I make a podcast with a couple friends called Buzzkill, and we're basically uploading to SoundCloud. It distributes to other apps.
Right.
We're not getting a ton of data and analytics from SoundCloud, although there's a little bit. Apple really hadn't provided much, but they recently updated their app to provide some like basic level of analytics, or they're going to do that later or something like that, right?
It's coming out, right? They made an announcement that they will share completion rates, I think, and some skip data.
Okay.
So it's not clear.
So kind of the basics.
Right. Yeah.
So what does 60dB provide for a podcaster? You know, why should I get my stuff on your app?
We should look at your data
yeah.
for your show.
You would realize that only a couple dozen people are listening, but...
Oh, that's okay. Listen to Buzzkill. I've listened. It's good. It's fun.
Not bad. It's not bad. So, if someone's making a podcast or doing whatever, comedy, news, why should they get it on 60dB?
So they should not only get it on 60dB, they should email me at steve@60db.co mm-hmm. and we can get you, if you're a creator, into our CMS. And what you'll see in the CMS is second by second information on when you're engaging your audience and when they skip. One of the things that we really haven't talked about is that it's really easy within our app to flip to the next story. So if we recommend something and you hate it, if we just missed, you swipe to the, I don't know if it's to the right or the left.
I think it's from the right to the left. Yeah. Because I was doing that this morning when I was brushing my teeth. I actually skipped a couple. I'm not going to name names, but.
Yeah, no, it happens.
Yeah.
And it's important, right? Like, so we make it pretty easy to skip, and that really gives creators interesting information about when they're losing the attention of their audience.
Mm-hmm.
As someone who told radio stories my entire life, I had no idea if that stuff was working or not, right?
Yeah.
Because I just press play, it goes out to 100,000 people. You don't know if they turn off the radio. And now we know. And we not only know, but we know when exactly. So a friend of mine, Dan Bobkopf, who used to work at Marketplace and NPR, did a story for Business Insider. And they started adding a pre-roll ad. And mm-hmm. it was a bad ad.
Mm.
And you could... Sorry, guys. You could see the effect of that. Dan gave me permission to talk about this show. Had a moment in one of his stories. It was like a 10-minute long story. And he brought up like some sad violin music in the middle. And people thought the story was over. So he lost 30% of his audience because he was like, oh, I'm not going to write a transition. Mm-hmm. Or like he just sent people the message that it was over and they bailed. And, you know, probably the biggest takeaway is that podcasts do much better if they have a strong lead. Like it's so important to like tell people what the story is about. You see like... I'm not going to name names, but you know there are lots of tech podcasts out there where the reporters will spend the first 10 minutes sort of like just shooting the shit.
Yeah.
Can I say that?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
And it's deadly.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
Like no one cares.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
you can lose an audience that way. Well, you know, one of the things that you all it seems like are pushing in terms of the content you're making yourself, you know, when you're reaching out to other news organizations to interview their reporters, whatever.
Right.
And one of the things that I enjoy about it, 60dB the most, is there's a lot of short form stuff. When I was at the Wall Street Journal, that was a big push there for the podcasts that the Journal was doing, was trying to get to like this 5 to 10 minute range. And it makes sense. I mean, not everybody has, you know, 2-3 hours to, to devote to one show or or whatever. So, and when you do, you want it to be really valuable. You want to know you're going to get a great listening experience back. Doesn't always happen, right? So where did the insight for these kind of shorter form a podcast come from? Was that something you all thought about before starting 60dB? Was that an industry trend, or is that actually shaped by this data that you're getting on people's listening habits?
So that was one of our theses when we started, was that there was this, that there was a disconnect between how, what people were listening to digitally and what people were listening to on the radio, and that the biggest audiences were actually radio shows that didn't look anything like the biggest podcasts.
Yeah.
So, you know, like All Things Considered, ESPN, Morning Edition, Marketplace, like outside of conservative talk, all the most popular shows are segmented, and typically the segment length is between 5 and 13 minutes. And people listen in the morning and the afternoon. You listen to, you look at when people listen to podcasts, and the biggest podcasts are like the time of listening tends to be in the evening and on the weekends. So like radio is a daily habit. Podcasting hadn't become a daily habit. And we were asking ourselves why. Yeah. And one of our thoughts was this was the missing piece, like something that could fill that somewhat unpredictable time when you're getting ready and you're on your commute or you're getting your kids out the door, and wasn't like, oh, I'm going to sit down for an hour, right? Was really interesting. And we figured we could make it more interesting than when you get over the radio by actually targeting what you were interested in and giving you the easy ability to skip. So like on a Friday, you say skip. And you could be, you know, up to your elbows in like a chicken cooking dinner, and you're not stuck listening to something that's dull.
Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about listener habits. How are people listening? Is it on their phones? Is it in their cars? Is it when you know, through their voice controlled speakers?
We don't have a huge number of Alexa listeners, but they tend to be our most loyal. I think the app works really well, so we'll get long listening sessions from that. A surprising number of people actually listen on Wi-Fi around their house. We were designed to make it really easy to listen to in the car. So, you know, you start a feed and you can just play it, and, you know, skip stories with big broad swipes. So it's not distracting when you're driving, is the idea.
And then you also have like Android Auto and CarPlay versions too,
right? And then, like, you know, if you have like a BMW or something, that most of those seem to work pretty well. It's tough because there are 1,001, but
a lot of variants there,
right? You know, I think that our mix of what people listen to has changed with our redesign. So we made it easier to listen to podcasts, and podcast listening has gone up the longer, when I say podcast, I'm thinking
longer
like
form.
20 minutes or more.
Yeah.
And so that is a, you know, there's a lot of great stuff there, and people are getting at that, which is exciting. But still the majority of our listening is morning, evening, and short form, but it's.
So do you think it's fair to say that your app, 60dB, is essentially like an answer to some industry problems and frustrations, but also kind of like this trend of what was happening with feeds and with on demand and all that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think on the creator side, we wanted to give creators better access to data, real insight into how people were listening and what worked and what didn't work, and allow them to not only see like which of their episodes worked, but how they compared to their competition, right? Not like in a broad sense.
Which is really data that you can't get from Spotify, SoundCloud, anywhere really right now.
From a consumer standpoint, we wanted to bring people the mix of stories that they really cared about that they weren't getting digitally. And then we also just saw, and I think we were right on the timing, that there were a whole bunch of things that were going to happen to how people listened that were going to be profoundly like interesting, right? So, you know, digital listening is breaking into the car. It's just much easier to listen on your smartphone. Android Auto and CarPlay, I saw reports recently that they are the most common new feature in new cars that's not required by law.
Yeah.
And so, you know, their market penetration is expected to reach 60% in the next few years. Point of reference, satellite radio is what, almost 20 years old now? Mm-hmm. It's at 70-75%. So, you know, very quickly, we're going to be streaming audio in cars. The other thing that I think is totally fascinating is all of these smart speakers that you can talk to, right? Mm-hmm. So radio is fundamentally, audio is fundamentally the media that you use when your eyes and hands are busy, which means you can't look at a screen and you can't touch buttons, right? Or that's mm-hmm. not mm-hmm. the easiest thing to do. So being able to say, you know, I'm not going to use any of these code words,
yeah, but yeah.
one of those words.
And then skip or
yeah, yeah, and then yeah. play or, you know, and we have redesigns in the works to allow you to search. So, mm-hmm. you know.
Okay, so-and-so. Yeah. Get me.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Right. Like,
well, so at that point though, will the app even matter? Will people even see the backbone? Will they know they're getting it from your service versus someone else's? Or will these voice controlled services and these big companies, Apple, Google, Amazon, mm-hmm. you know, whoever else delivers, Microsoft, they're all playing in this space.
Right. What's to prevent them from doing it?
Yeah. Or elbowing you guys out.
Two things. One is that they don't play nicely together, right?
So, that is true, unfortunately.
Right. So if you're listening on your Android in your yeah. car and you go launch the Alexa skill mm-hmm. in your home, we know where you were and we pick up, right? So there's a level of personalization. Like we know what you're into.
Yeah.
And that's connected on our back end to any device you listen on.
And you work across devices. And
exactly.
So,
right.
know, so ecosystems and all that.
So our ability to reach you on any speaker and deliver a consistent experience on any speaker, I think in the long term is going to be a competitive advantage that mm-hmm. they're going to struggle against, not because it's a technical challenge, but because
it's business challenge.
It's a business challenge. Right.
Yeah.
The other thing that I think it will be our long-term competitive advantage is that you come not for an app, you come for the content, right? And so if we provide a better business model to publishers, we will have better content mm-hmm. and that will be a competitive advantage. And you know, to use the Netflix example, that's what they're doing. They do a lot of original production, but they also write $1 billion check to Disney each year, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Once that ecosystem develops, it becomes a powerful moat. So that business model in combination with better knowledge of consumer tastes, I think, will ultimately provide a way that we can provide a really great service to a bunch of different people. And that doesn't just like get wiped out by Google Home.
Yeah. Yeah. So with that, I mean, obviously since you all have some ex Netflix folks on your mm-hmm. team and some former Facebook folks as well, who like worked mm-hmm. on Newsfeed and things like that. How are you balancing tech driven curation versus human driven curation in your app? I mean, there's kind of an ongoing debate, especially on the music side. Mm-hmm. Apple's saying, hey, you know, we got the tech side, but we've got great editors and people right. who are curating these playlists you can't get anywhere else. Spotify has its, you know, pretty much algorithmic approach. Of course, Google has its take. Everyone's take is slightly right. different, kind right. of a slightly different balance.
It's a really interesting issue in news too, right?
Yeah.
Because you look, especially in Facebook, you have these open ecosystems, right? And they have algorithmic feeds that reflect back at you a version of your own interests, right?
Mm-hmm. So, which in Facebook's situation has created what people are calling a bubble, and mm-hmm. saying that it's kind of detrimental for
right.
an ongoing dialogue, especially on the social and political side,
right? And it sort of distorts people's view of reality, right? Because
yeah.
you think the whole world agrees with you because that's what you see on Facebook.
Yeah.
So I have a couple thoughts. At a high level, I think that the best artificial intelligence algorithms are ultimately driven by their ability to capture human insights, right? So Google search took off because it recognized that a hyperlink was like a citation in an academic article. It was a recommendation, mm-hmm. and it was a recommendation of a thoughtful person, right? Mm-hmm. And but it could, you know, they could create a machine that would scan through and capture those recommendations. And until people started gaming that system, it worked really well. So I don't actually think that human decision making and AI are actually in opposition to each other. I think that the challenge is to figure out how to create the most like perceptive machine that listens to the best signals. And so one of the things that I'm really excited about us doing in the future is working to capture signals from editors, right? So, you know, I mentioned that we have a CMS that gives mm-hmm. publishers lots of data. I'd also love to know what those publishers think of individual stories. So if I'm you know, putting together a you know, your soccer show, what's the short form soccer show?
The Goal Mouth from Howler magazine.
Right.
It's like it's 5 minutes a day. It's fantastic. Like,
yeah. The people who put that together mm-hmm. know soccer so yeah. much better than me, right? Yeah. Or our engineers.
Yeah.
And so what is going to be valuable is our ability to capture those insights into soccer. What's the soccer story of the day that we should be covering? Or this morning from the New York Times or from NPR, like what are the lead stories of the day? Should it be, you know, a follow-up on the Comey hearing, coverage of Russian, you know, human rights protests, and then combining that with your interests, right? So if we just looked at your interests the way Facebook just looks at your interests, you get a lagging indicator and you don't get a very diverse view. Like, you know, an editor in the Times newsroom is going to know about world events probably before you will, unless you're on Twitter, right?
But, yeah.
And then the other thing that I think is totally fascinating, and this actually comes out of the work that these guys did at Netflix. Netflix had a constrained content catalog, right? So they didn't have infinite choice. They couldn't just give you an infinite like number of Sex and the City episodes in 1990,
yeah,
you know, like
yeah,
2002, right? Because they would run out. The season would end. And if they knew you liked that show and the season ended and they didn't have something that was similar but different to suggest to you, they'd lose you as a subscriber. So their algorithms actually approach that problem differently. They did a lot of research into different characteristics of a show that you might like, and they'd give you three or four things that they knew you were into, like strong female characters in the case mm-hmm. of Sex and the City, you know, in a relationship that was complicated, and then maybe they'd give you a different characteristic that from a different show that would work. So like instead of being a group of single women in the city, it's a group of single women in a prison and it's Orange is the New Black, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And so you can have algorithmic approaches that introduce diversity. And I think in a news context, that sort of breaks the filter bubble, and is pretty valuable. So
awesome. Well, this is a great place to take another break for our second ad of the show. We're here with Steve Henn, the co-founder of 60DB, and we'll be right back.
Thanks.
This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Let's be real. The mortgage process was outdated. It needed to catch up with the times, up with our lifestyle. And that's why Rocket Mortgage was created by Quicken Loans. The mortgage experience, it was dated, and it needed a client-focused technological revolution. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's also convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. It's powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in seconds. Based on your income, assets, and credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of the home loan options for which you qualify and find the one that's right just for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. That's rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of Triangulation. All right, we're back with Steve Henn, the co-founder of 60DB. And we are just talking about the potential for basically your dynamic playlists and your kind of balance of humans and technology-driven curation,
right,
to hopefully break out of the filter bubble that is plaguing Facebook and their news feed. There's interesting potential there, but at the same time, you know, it's a lot of faith to put into algorithms, right? And right, as we've seen, you know, Google, which is like one of the companies that's the best at this, still makes mistakes, right? Still right, places, you know, maybe ads next to hateful content on YouTube, right, or they still, like, you know, racistly misidentify, you know, people in search results or whatever and things like that. I mean, these are big, big, never-ending problems. I mean, can algorithms do all those things, or will you always need some sort of human element, some editor or whatever, to be there and keep some of the stuff in check?
I don't know about always. Mm-hmm. I do know that right now we have a human element. So, you know, we started experimenting with introducing political diversity into people's feeds. And one of the things that I noticed really quickly is some of the content that we were surfacing for people just didn't meet my editorial standards, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, if you were interested in certain subjects, we might see that, you know, Alex Jones or RT were covering those things. And you know, if you listen to some of that coverage, it became pretty clear that they were sort of hiding behind anonymous sources to spread rumors in ways that I didn't feel were journalistically credible.
Yeah.
And so we made the decision to remove those sources from the system.
And those can be tough choices because, especially in the case of Alex Jones, they can be quite popular, even if they're
right,
not technically journalism.
Right.
Or credible news sources or whatever.
Right. You know, so I gave a lot of thought to what standards we should live by, mm-hmm, and how we were going to articulate those and enforce them consistently. And ultimately, I think that you know, repeated you know, publication of unverified material combined with unwillingness to publish corrections when it's clear that you have made an error,
yeah,
or your unnamed sources are not credible, that those two things were enough to remove a source. And it's not a political, I mean, one of the examples was, a you know, RT is Russia Today, mm-hmm, right? So it's and one was on the right, but I think there are more and more journalists on the left, especially in this era of Trump, that are using the same playbook, and we're going to apply the same sources to them,
mm-hmm,
or
mm-hmm,
the same standards, excuse me, to them.
How do you telegraph to users that, you know, your app, your service is coming with a level of vetting, so to, mm-hmm, speak, of the content that you're going to find there versus, say, something like Apple's podcast app or Google's search engine or their apps or whatever, which are...
Or YouTube,
yeah,
right,
which are really, you know, if that sort of thing happens there, someone might claim, oh, Google's being a censor. That's censorship.
Right.
They're a utility. Just give me the search results and get out of my way.
Right. Yeah, so that's an interesting question. I mean, I think ultimately we want to create an ecosystem that is more similar to sort of the App Store, the mm-hmm, Apple App Store, mm-hmm, than YouTube, right? So it's an open ecosystem.
But there are rules.
But there are rules, right?
Yeah.
And so our rules are, you know, we're not going to distribute hate speech. We're not going to distribute stories that are, you know, incite violence, and we are not going to distribute stories that run afoul of sort of malicious libel of a public figure. That's the legal standard, but it is you know, when you know or should have known that what you're broadcasting is false. Mm-hmm. And that's a line that I think is pretty clear, but also pretty open, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and I think that, you know, that falls short of the censorship of ideas, but it does require responsibility, and a certain standard of civil behavior that fundamentally I believe is necessary for democracy to work, right?
Like, yeah.
I mean, one of the problems in the UGC free-for-all world is that it puts content that is malicious, false, on equal footing with stories that are based in research and, you know, a search for at least, if not objective fact, mm-hmm. some level of truth.
Mm-hmm. Well, given that you know, these are industry-wide problems for mm-hmm. for the news industry, journalism, for distribution platforms like Facebook and Google and all these other places. Mm-hmm. And if you have some sort of insights and you guys learn some things that could inform how to distinguish these types of content better, you know, what do you do with that? Because you're a business and you have to keep some things close to your chest, right?
Right.
But in journalism, the world that you came from, it's...
So if we solve this problem, should we share it?
Well, I guess basically, right? Or do you keep that as kind of like a reason why your app is better than someone else's? Because, you know, in the past, there was this separation, you know, for you in mm-hmm. journalism, you know, between the business side and the editorial side, mm-hmm. right? And now you're working in a space that dabbles in both.
Right, personally.
Yeah, personally.
Right.
Yeah.
So, look, I think if we're able to create a truly diverse platform that is always credible and
yeah.
not sort of polluted with noise or propaganda... and there's a secret sauce to that. Hopefully we'd be commercially successful and we would grow and others yeah. would imitate us. But
that's the dream though, huh?
That's the dream, right?
Yeah.
Like I would say that places like YouTube and Facebook, which have built their business on user generated content and not paying for it, have created a harder problem for themselves, mm-hmm. right? Their very existence is premised on the fact that anyone can upload anything at any time.
Which is somewhat democratizing and allows more people to take part in the conversation.
Right, right.
But, you know, but also...
And it's really powerful
yeah.
because of that.
But it's kind of a double-edged sword in that sense.
It's kind of a double-edged sword. And I think what they're struggling with is how to scale a set of standards across these enormous, enormous ecosystems that... are enforceable. And that's mm-hmm. that's a tough problem when it is completely open. And when at this point you have, you know, people who have now had years and years of experience in figuring out how to generate clicks from false stories, right?
Yeah.
And make a lot of money on it. Like
yeah.
there are big, powerful incentives in those spaces.
Yeah. Can be tough. Well, to get out of the political and social responsibility realm a little bit, let's talk about what you're all doing with video and audio. And
sure.
in 60dB, you're surfacing both, which is slightly different than some podcast apps.
Mm-hmm.
I personally really like that, especially with what we do here at Twit.
Yep.
You know, we're delivering our netcasts in both video form and audio form.
Right.
What does the future of 60dB look like? Are you guys going to do more video, or is that really just going to be kind of dependent on, is that something you're seeking out, or is that dependent on what content creators are bringing to you?
Well, it was an interesting evolution. It occurred to us, and Steve McClendon, who really is the product genius who's mm-hmm. driving the shape of it, realized early on that there were lots of video providers who were telling stories a lot like this, right? Like
yeah.
two guys behind a mic.
Yeah.
You don't need to, I mean, you're a good looking guy, but you don't need to,
we don't need to look
to
at
see
our
your face.
Beautiful
right.
faces
right.
all of the time. Yeah.
No,
yeah.
this works yeah. as a radio show.
Yeah.
So, he had that insight that, and we started thinking about it and realized that if, you know, if there's someone sitting behind a desk,
mm-hmm.
whether it's a comedy show or a news show, it often works. As more often than not, it works yeah. as as audio. And what we were aiming at wasn't like replacing radio. We were aiming at this time that people have when they can't look at screens, but they want to be entertained and informed. And from when you start thinking about it that way, it makes complete sense. And so I think my guess is that the two will merge more and more. The next version of the Echo is going to have a screen on it. I think that as cars become more likely to be self-driving cars, it just made sense for us as a company with an eye on the future to think about, you know, how can this system work in both ways? And you can minimize the video.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we're exploring is whether or not we can just have a toggle to turn it off if you're in a place where you just don't want pictures flashing at you.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, you've actually changed the way that I've been watching John Oliver on Last Week Tonight, because I'm listening to him, and then if it sounds like something I just need to see, I'll just skip back 15 seconds and then I can see it.
Right.
So, you know, I'm sure, I don't know how HBO would feel about that, but it's an interesting dynamic being able to kind of move back and forth between those two things. At the same time, the best speakers in my home are in my living room.
Right.
And you guys don't have yet an app on my PlayStation, my Xbox, my Apple TV.
You can AirPlay to Apple.
You can AirPlay. Okay.
Yeah. The video will show up.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. Uh-huh. Awesome. Well, all right. Well, then I stand corrected on that one. But, and you have some Chromecast capability as well?
I think so.
Maybe.
So I am not the product guy. Right. Okay. Before we started, I tried to Slack Steve McClendon,
all right,
who's other Steve on Slack, to see if Chromecast is working.
Sorry to put you on the spot like that. Okay.
But, you know.
So do you see potential for an app for 60 dB that is built for the television? I mean, you know, Facebook and Twitter and, you know, they're trying to play with live video on the bigger screen. You know, a lot of podcast apps, Spotify, they have TV screens. But it seems like no one's really figured out what they're doing there if they're not Netflix, if they're not, you know, your iTunes store or Google Play or Amazon Prime Video.
Look, there's a big sort of category of television that is similar to what we do, like 5-to-7-minute stories, right?
Yeah.
And like there are a lot of YouTube creators with big followings like Phil DeFranco whose work would fit really well in this context. And so I think between Chromecast, if it's working, I think it's working,
and
AirPlay on Apple TV, I feel like for now that's probably where we're going to be for a while, because it's really simple to just throw the service onto your screen and you'll get a mix of stuff.
Yeah.
So I think that a video-centric service around short form, there's a market for that, right? Like, clearly. And it's one of the interesting things about data. So we started early on testing a bunch of different content, and one of the standouts was late night comedy monologues, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you just look at their engagement, even when there was no picture, they did really well. And so from those tests, we went out and pursued deals to get rights to do that.
Okay, makes sense. So one of the I don't know if it's a frustration or maybe a comfort zone for me, but as a journalist, you know, a lot of the stuff that we're doing, I mean, it's different here at TWiT because it's, you know, they're conversations and news analysis, things like this. But at newspapers, we've really been writing the same style of story for more than 100 years.
Yeah.
Now they're on the internet instead of a printed page, right?
Right.
At television stations, even though they're distributing stuff on the internet, they're still largely sitting behind a desk and doing like an anchor style, the same thing that they've been doing since the 50s or whatever, right?
Right.
With audio reporting, there is a format, there's a formula, and there's the NPR model, right?
Yeah. You know,
which is its own style.
Yeah.
And then there's maybe the podcast style, which is a little looser and might include cuss words and things like that every once in a while. But it seems like despite all of these, you know, tech advancements, despite all these fantastic tools that we have, we're still kind of playing in the same types of content and the same types of story. When are we going to get to companies like 60DB or like Google or like, you know, some tech startup that doesn't even exist yet, creating a genuine new type of content form that really fits these different types of ways we're consuming tech, or am I being too self-critical of, you know, journalism as an entire industry and as a whole?
Well, so look, I think you've seen that already, right? Like Twitter didn't exist, like communicating in those characters, having those kinds of public exchanges.
It's a new form of public dialogue that didn't exist.
Instagram and Snapchat, I think, have made it possible to communicate with pictures in new ways and in like in different moods.
But you know, those are somewhat low quality ish. If it's being fair, like the video on Snapchat often looks crummy and low resolution, right? And production standards are not high.
Yeah.
And as great as Twitter is, you only have 140 characters per tweet, right?
Right. Right. Look, I think there are definitely opportunities for that. And there are things that we've talked about internally. I think one of the sort of superpowers of digital technology, like one is personalization and the idea that you don't have to create a linear broadcast. Mm-hmm. I think another one is interactivity, right? Like in the ability to connect with your audiences. And you can do that for a business purpose by, you know, instead of having like a horrible tote bag driven pledge drive, like me, just being straight with your audience and being like, hey, it takes money to do this.
Yeah.
Like if you donate, you'll get fewer ads or no ads, right? Like that's a possibility. But there's another one, which I've always been excited about, which is, you know, having the ability with a microphone to speak to your audience and ask them to speak back to you. Like Twit has an incredibly engaged audience. When we've talked about stuff here, we get a lot of feedback.
Yeah, I get more emails and tweets here than I have any other place I've been.
Right. And I think that you know, one of the things I'd be really interested in doing in the future in our company is figuring out how to allow folks to just press a button on their phone and talk back to us, and then how to understand what people are saying at scale. So, like, building a system for producers of automatic transcription that was searchable. I did a story when Instagram was bought for NPR, and we had a couple hundred thousand people on our Instagram feed at NPR. We sent out a message the day of the purchase, and we're like, hey, if you're interested in talking to us about this and you're a big Instagram fan, you know, it was just on iOS at that time. Hit your voice memo app and send the voice memo to Steve, and I like created a Gmail account.
Yeah.
And in just a few minutes I got 20 you know recordings from like diehard Instagram followers from all over the country. One person recorded it on the beach, you could hear the sound, and it was this glimmer of a really powerful reporting tool that doesn't exist yet. So clearly, like,
making that easier.
There's a lot of potential here. There is a long road ahead. And it's interesting to think about how it could play out.
Awesome. Well, you've got some big problems to solve. No pressure. But it would be nice if you could figure this stuff out for the industry and journalism as a whole, and for all of Silicon Valley, too. Thank you so much, Steve. Where can people find you on the internet?
So you can follow me on Twitter, at Hens Eggs, H-E-N-N-S. E-G-G-S. My parents, I grew up in Iowa and my parents sold eggs. So,
all right. So you're not just being funny. It actually is like
the family trademark. That I don't know if they trademarked it, but I got teased a lot. So
that's awesome.
I'm owning it. So at Hens Eggs.
All right. And 60DB is the app.
60DB.
Where can folks get it if they want to give it a shot?
You can download it from iTunes and Google Play. Mm-hmm. And we also have a great Alexa skill you should check out. You should do all of those.
Yeah.
And more soon. Thanks.
All right. Yeah, we'll see where it goes. Thanks for being on. And that is episode 301 of Triangulation. We'll be back next week with someone else.
All right.
I actually don't know who it is, but thanks for coming on, Steve.
Thank you.
All right.
Take care.